Hello and welcome to our Institute's colloquium. This is today already the seventh lecture in the series, and I would like to take the occasion to remind us very shortly that one concern of this lecture series is to find out to which extent different notions and understandings of the political might be useful in ethnographic research on the one hand, and in our explorations of the political moment we are currently traversing on the other hand. At the very beginning, we had Dáce Zenoska as our guest, and a little bit later, Moritz Ege, and both in their own way referred to Chantal Mouffe's notion of the political as a source of inspiration to develop their respective interpretation of the contemporary. Elizabeth Dunn, in the second lecture, introduced her critical reading of Alain Badiou's notions of the normal situation on the one hand and the event on the other hand, in order to argue for an understanding of the political as she writes, the process of constituting a coherent and actionable world in the aftermath of a fundamental rupture, so like a war, refuge, displacement, or disasters. So the process of constituting a coherent and actionable world in the aftermath of such a fundamental rupture that destroys the once normal situation. That would be the political, according to Elizabeth Dunn, referring to Alain Badiou. I first met our today's speaker, Chana Bulkovich, through one of her articles, the article The Everyday Life of a Homo Saker, that she published in 2017. And in this article, Chana argues for an understanding of politics, I quote, as an inherent aspect of all social relations rather than as a separate field of practice. Politics refers to a particular redistribution of the ability to live a good life and is therefore a dimension of any social encounter. For me, this very wording, once again, politics refers to a particular redistribution of the ability to live a good life and is therefore a dimension of any social encounter. This very wording sounded as inspiring as promising, and not least as it seemed to open another analytical avenue to examine the political dimension of social life compared to the perhaps more familiar perspectives referring to antagonism or rupture as starting point to explore the political. In the next paragraph in this article, Chana quotes Judith Butler to endorse her own understanding of politics or the political. We could discuss your take on the difference between the two notions later on, perhaps. So she quotes Judith Butler, and in this quote, Judith Butler expresses, "To be outside established and legitimate political structures is still to be saturated in power relations. And this saturation is the point for departure for a theory of the political that includes dominant and subjugated forms, modes of inclusion and legitimation, as well as modes of delegitimation and effacement." Based on my reading of this article, which is not only based on theory, but as well on ethnographical material collected in Montenegro, and which is, I think, a very good example how to connect theoretical positions, theoretical concepts, and ethnographic material. So based on this article, I thought it could be an enriching contribution to this lecture series to learn more about Judith Butler's conceptual frame to think the political, and above that, how this conceptual frame could be made productive in ethnographic research. I addressed Chana if she could imagine to elaborate a little bit more on these questions, on Judith Butler's contribution, conceptual frame to think the political, and she was so kind to accept our invitation. Chana Brilković studied ethnology and anthropology at the University of Belgrade and did her PhD in social anthropology at the University of Manchester, where she was supervised by Sarah Green and Steph Janssen. I mentioned this because we had Steff Jansen here as our guest in February, so some of you might know him. After her PhD, she was postdoctoral fellow at three places, at the Central European University in Budapest, the New Europe College in Bucharest, as well as the Graduate School for East and Southeast European Studies in Regensburg. And since this semester, Czarna works at our sister department in Göttingen at the Institute for Cultural Ethnology and European Ethnology, where she works as a postdoctoral lecturer. I would like to mention two of her newer publications. Firstly, one book she wrote based on her dissertation and which was published in Berkan 2017, Managing Ambiguity, How Clientelism, Citizenship and Power Shape Personhood in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And the second book is an edited volume she published together with Steff Jansen and Vanya Celebicic, which has the title Negotiating Social Relations in Bosnia and Herzegovina, Semi-Peripheral Entanglements. And this was published by Routledge in New York. And I think as well, 2016, which is basically a collection of newer anthropological, ethnographic work on Bosnia-Herzegovina, but as she explained to me, commented by sociologists and political scientists, so somehow trying to open an interdisciplinary debate on current developments in Bosnia-Herzegovina. So I'm very happy and grateful that you are here today, and I'm looking forward to your contribution to our lecture series, which has the title Doing Gender in a Refugee Camp, Politics and Ethics Beyond a Subject.
I first want to thank you for having me here today. I want to thank Jens for inviting me and putting this major task on my shoulders, which was also very productive for me. Preparing for this lecture was very, very helpful and productive for me, and I want to thank you for coming here today. It is a true pleasure to be able to share my ongoing research with all of you and to hear your thoughts on it. So I started doing this research in 2015 in Montenegro. Montenegro is a small country in southeastern Europe. You can see its position in Europe on the screen. It is a former Yugoslav country. And more specifically, I conducted long-term ethnographic fieldwork in and around a camp for internally displaced people in Podgorica. Podgorica is the capital of Montenegro. I myself am from Montenegro. My parents live in Podgorica, so I have a lot of personal social connections to my field site. And one of the key questions that emerged out of this fieldwork for me personally was, can one lead a good life in a bad life? So if no, why not? And if yes, under what conditions? And this is a philosophical question that was asked by Theodor Adorno and taken up by a range of philosophers, including Judith Butler in her book Notes Toward the Performative Theory of Assembly. And this is the question I want to discuss with you today by using my ethnographic material and Judith Butler's theoretical framework. So can one lead a good life in a bad life? This is a tricky question to ask. It is potentially politically problematic. Does it make sense to even mention the term, the notion of a good life in relationship to people who live in situations of long-term encampment, in poverty or precarity, or under economic sanctions? So is it politically responsible to even ask this question in relationship to these oppressed groups of people? Does posing this question mean refusing to recognize their suffering? Are we just saying, oh, they live poorly, but they still manage to lead a good life, so it's not really urgent to improve their living conditions? Judith Butler says that there is no easy way to answer this question, and certainly no easy way to escape its claim upon us, and I would agree with this. I think it is a tricky but important question. How to lead a good life is a key question of morality. So if we say that issues of good life should not be discussed in relationship to residents of refugee camps, for instance, we are effectively denying ethical and moral capabilities to them, to the refugees. So we are saying that these people live so poorly and they're so deprived of anything but their own bare life that issues of morality and ethics have nothing to do with them. So to answer this question with a no is dehumanizing, in my view, as I will later ethnographically illustrate. Butler suggests that issues of good life, so issues of morality, are from their inception bound with biopolitics, that is, with forms of power that organize and sustain some lives within a polity, so within a political community. They dispose of some other lives and generally establish a set of measures for evaluating lives in different ways. So any life needs a structure to support it, and biopolitics is the form of power that operates through such a structure, through healthcare, through housing, social and economic support, employment, political rights, and so on. So if we take this into account, how can we think about the good life and relationship with residents of a refugee camp in Konik, a neighborhood in Podgorica, where I did my fieldwork? So the Konik camp was established in the year 2000 as a shelter for around 4,000 Roma, Balkan Egyptians, and Meshkalia who left neighboring Kosovo in 1998 and 1999 due to war violence. They found refuge in Podgorica, where a nexus of international humanitarian organizations and state institutions set up this camp as an emergency accommodation. In 1999, 130,000 people escaped from Kosovo to Montenegro, which increased the population of this country by a fifth, because Montenegro has 650,000 inhabitants in total. After the end of war violence, many displaced persons returned to Kosovo, or they went to the so-called third country, so to Germany, Italy, Albania, and so on. But the 4,000 residents of this camp stayed in Podgorica, and many had been living there in the camp from the 2000 until last year, 2017, and a few hundred people still live in this camp. So can we say they pursued a good life if they had lived for almost 20 years in the midst of a very bad life in this camp? And the answer that I want to discuss with you today is that by working towards being a moral person, camp residents resisted the bad life in this Konik camp, or more specifically, carving oneself into a particular kind of a moral woman offered my interlocutors a way to resist the forms of biopolitics which made them disposable. And I should emphasize here that for me, good life does not present a possession or something a person has or does not have. Instead, I understand good life as a direction of a pursuit. So people work towards a good life without ever really reaching it, whether they live in refugee camps or in large houses with lots of flowers. People develop imagination of what a good life looks like, and they perpetually try to cite this vision, regardless of the material conditions they live in. There's always a piece of a puzzle missing from having the good life as a completed project. So if we have healthcare, decent housing, and paid employment, we want kids, or we want a new sexual partner, or we want to enter into a polyamorous relationship, and so on. So having a good life is an inherently impossible project, or at least perpetually delayed project. That being said, this does not mean that all people have equal chances to pursue their projects of a good life, far from it. This pursuit needs to be supported by institutional structures, and institutional support, so reliable, predictable organization and sustenance of life, this is what makes some lives less valuable than others. It is institutional support that makes a difference in whether or not a person lives a bad life. If good life is a pursuit, a perpetually delayed project, bad life, in my reading, is an objective condition of not having the institutional support that organizes and sustains life. So good life remains a goal to strive toward, even in the absence of institutional structures that organize and sustain life. Not only does it remain a goal, the argument of my talk today is that pursuing a good life can present a form of political resistance to the absence of institutional structures that organize and sustain life. In other words, working towards being a moral person, can a moral woman, for example, can be a way to resist the devaluation and emptiness created by absence of institutionally organized healthcare, social economic support, employment, and political rights. While making this argument, I also want to briefly turn to how we think about resistance. Almost 30 years ago, Lila Boluchod warned that anthropologists like to romanticize resistance, that we like to, and this is a quote, to read all forms of resistance as signs of the ineffectiveness of systems of power and of the resilience and creativity of the human spirit in its refusal to be dominated. Following Foucault, Abu Lukhod says that we should approach resistance differently as a way to diagnose power. So where there is resistance, there is power, writes Abu Lukhod. I agree with this, and I would like to suggest further that resistance is never absolute. Instead, it is partial, and it is shaped by possibilities opened up in a wider field of power. So what means resistance in one sense, from one perspective, can be compliance and citation of hegemonic discourses in another. So in my fieldwork in the Konik camp, there were multiple forms of power intersecting and operating simultaneously. And conservative citations of one hegemonic discourse, that of gender and home, provided means to resist the effects of another hegemonic discourse, that of neoliberal biopolitics, which equated camp residents with garbage. In other words, citing a fairly conservative idea of what a woman should behave like and what a home should look like, offered women from the Kony camp a way to resist this hegemonic organization of biopower, which made them disposable and ungrievable in Butler's terms, and performing gender at home in a fairly conservative way offered the women a way to attach themselves to some kind of a social structure and to establish their value in the face of detachment from the state politics and institutional structures which refuse to see them as anything but garbage, more or less. So reproducing this hegemonic discourse on gender at home offered the ground to the women to resist a different kind of a hegemonic structure, which worked on turning them into a bare life. In order to make this argument, I will first describe the objective conditions of life in this Kony camp, its history, in a way. Then I will briefly discuss Butler's conception of the political, and I will introduce my argument in more detail. And in the second part of the talk, I will ethnographically illustrate how women from the camp responded to these structures which made them disposable, and what this can tell us about resistance. So the camp, the Kony camp was initially a tent settlement. It was erected by humanitarian agencies, and the tent settlement was destroyed by a storm in December 1999. 3 months later, the Italian humanitarian organization Intersos built the first segment of the camp using wooden barracks, which you can see on the screen. And they had the support of the UNHCR and some support of the Montenegrin state. American humanitarian organization World Vision built the second segment following the same model. And Intersos's vision of what to do regarding the displaced Roma in Podgorica, in Montenegro, was likely informed by the situation in Italy. In Italy, in 2000, there were so many camps for the displaced Roma that it was called the campland. So Intersos built 41 wooden barracks that had 8 rooms of 15 square meters each. And in the first few months, the barracks got electricity, but there was no running water in the barracks. Instead, the camp had 4 sanitary blocks with shared toilets, showers, and taps with tap water. And the same wooden barracks and the same shared toilets and showers remained in use for the next 12 years. There were 56 humanitarian organizations working in the Kony camp when it was initially built in 2000, so this was a proper humanitarian chaos. 3 years later, Intersos and World Vision left. They moved on to the next humanitarian hotspot, and Montenegrin Red Cross took over the management of the camp with the financial support of the UNHCR. And around 2,500 people, so 2,500 people lived in the camp during the 2000s, more than 400 families. And at the time of my fieldwork, there were still 1,500 people living in the camp. So this was the largest refugee camp in the Balkans for almost 2 decades. During the 2000s, different parts of the camp were destroyed in several separate fires. And I found data in the Montenegrin media about major fires in 2001, 2007, 2008, 2 times in 2009, 1 in 2011. And in 2012, there was a major fire which destroyed most of the camp. And only then did the Montenegrin government decide to replace these wooden barracks by metal containers after this major fire destroyed most of the camp. The continuous problems with the fires were caused by the low-level construction of these wooden barracks by the Intersos in 2000. Throughout this period, Montenegrin state authorities had little interest in this urban enclave, and for various reasons. First, they were preoccupied with the incoming 2006 referendum on the independence of Montenegro. And second, the state authorities saw these people who were living in the camp, so IDPs, as someone else's responsibility, the responsibility of Kosovo or of Serbia or humanitarians, just not of the Montenegrin state. And this ignorance is reflected in the ambiguous legal status of the camp residents. So they were initially registered as IDPs, or internally displaced people, because in 1999, when they fled from Kosovo to Montenegro, Kosovo and Montenegro belonged to the same state. It was called the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia. And they had not crossed the recognized state border back then. Their legal status was ambiguous ever since Montenegro declared independence from this Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, or State Union of Serbia and Montenegro, as it was called in 2006. And with Montenegrin independence, these people were not internally displaced anymore. And there was now a state border between them and their place of origin. 2 years later, Kosovo also proclaimed independence from Serbia, which Serbia still disputes. And importantly, the IDPs were not given the status of refugees or foreigners or citizens after Montenegrin independence. So in legal terms, they remained to be IDPs. So the Montenegrin state failed to include these internally displaced persons as a legal category into any piece of legislature, so they were legally invisible. As a result, in the mid-2000s, the IDPs could not find legal employment. So Montenegrin parliament adopted several new laws that regulated access to the labor market for citizens, for refugees, and for foreigners, but no mention of the IDPs. There was no legal procedure for these people from the camp, for example, to get employment. Since Yugoslavia did not exist anymore, even if they had Yugoslav passports before then, they meant nothing. Similarly, children from the camp could not attend regular public schools. Instead, the humanitarians, with the help of the state, organized a special segregated school within the camp. Public healthcare system adopted new healthcare software, which did not have built-in features for the IDPs. Again, it only had built-in features for the three legally recognized categories of residents, and this made it impossible for camp residents to access public healthcare through the institutional channel. So they were simply invisible for the public healthcare systems, and when they needed any sort of healthcare, the humanitarian organizations had to step in and help them get it. And these examples clearly indicated the state was not really absent from the camp, but neither was it evenly and systematically present. So partially blind towards the IDPs, Montenegrin state executed some governmental decisions over certain aspects of life in the Koni camp, but simultaneously it refused to see these camp residents as legal subjects with responsibilities and rights to work or healthcare. And this is I think this is a very good example of how neoliberal biopolitics can work. So biopolitics in the 20th century model of a Western welfare state was totalizing. It aimed to include every member of a political community within its reach. So improvement was imagined as possible and desirable for all who live in a certain territory. Neoliberal biopolitics, however, is much more selective. It selectively works on improvement of some people while others get discarded. And it has led to a great increase of disposable persons throughout the world, and this includes people who have been living in the Koni camp. Eric Fassin writes that neoliberal power or biopower is not about making die, it's not either about making live. So it's not the old sovereignty, but it's not the new biopower. It's something else. What I would argue is that it's about not letting live without making die, that is making life unlivable. And this, I think, sums up really nicely the main characteristics of this neoliberal biopolitics that was present in the Koni camp. And by this term, neoliberal biopolitics, I mean a global dissipation of stable frameworks for organizing life. So the exact contours of this dissipation are different in different places. Such stable frameworks for organizing life in the 20th century may have been provided by the state or by working places such as factories, universities, and so on. The important thing for me here is that during the process of neoliberalization, relations between the state, society, and citizens have been transforming away from this welfare state model towards something else, towards humanitarianism, for example. Fink, Lewis, and Clark suggest that neoliberalism brought about a shift in the filaments suturing the people to state and welfare away from rights and towards the idea of duty and responsibility. And the Koni camp is a good illustration of this. Its residents had no legal rights to claim anything from the state. So they had almost no political or social rights. Everything they got was a result of humanitarian sense of duty and responsibility. So ambiguously living in a legal limbo between citizens and refugees, their survival depended on humanitarian and state compassion for 20 years. The situation in the Koni camp changed drastically when the European Commission expressed interest in it. In 2010, the European Commission defined the Koni camp as one of seven priority problems that Montenegro had to resolve if it wanted to open the negotiation process. So Montenegro wants to join the EU, and this somehow got things going among the Montenegrin officials when it comes to the Koni camp. So the promise of EU integration had a clear and direct effect on the life of the people in the camp. And the Montenegrin authorities suddenly started claiming that the camp had to be closed as soon as possible. And they developed a number of steps to do so. So first, they adopted a national strategy to close the camp. Second, they resolved the ambiguous legal status of the IDPs. And as a result, camp residents slowly started obtaining new personal documents, proving their status as a foreigner. Those who are registered as foreigners who have these new personal documents have the same social rights as Montenegrin citizens, but they have no political rights. They cannot vote, for instance. After 2010, the Montenegrin government enabled children from the camp to attend city schools, so before they had this segregated school in the camp. After 2010, camp residents were legally allowed, institutionally supported, to join the public healthcare system and the labor market and so on. And the final major change after 2010 was that the government built new social housing for the camp residents. So more than 16 buildings were constructed right next to the camp with the financial support of the European Union. Montenegrin state provided the land, and the funding for the construction came from the EU. And most camp residents have moved there into these buildings last year, and almost the whole camp was dismantled after that. So this is the background story of the Kony camp. It's history, let's say. Now I'll focus on the question, so how did camp residents engage with these structures that made them partially visible and disposable? So how can we understand this shadowy domain of existence in which my interlocutors lived for almost two decades? So how did people from the camp try to lead a good life if the state largely ignored them, choosing to see their existence only in humanitarian terms rather than in legal and political terms? As we will see, camp residents pursue their own visions of a good life in very gendered ways. Men organized major public protests in the city of Podgorica in 2005. So after Intersos and World Vision left the camp in 2003, Montenegrin Red Cross took over the management of the camp with the financial support of the UNHCR. However, 6 years after the war, the camp was not considered to be a humanitarian emergency anymore. And this is why there was significantly less money for the maintenance of the camp. And camp residents were not satisfied with this change in management and in finances. So a group of men from the camp organized protests in front of the UNHCR and OSCE offices in the city. And they asked for a number of things. Most importantly, they asked to have to take over the management of the camp through their Roma NGOs. They also wanted the UNHCR to give funds to construct residential buildings and to support their employment. So they wanted a life with decent housing, with employment, and with some sort of protection. However, the humanitarians rejected the demands of the camp residents and quieted their protests. So similar protests were never again organized in the city. And in our talks, the Red Cross and UNHCR representatives told me that they did not see the protesters as legitimate representatives of all the residents of the camp. When I asked them why they stopped the protests, they said they did not trust the experience and the accountability of these newly established Roma NGOs. And the humanitarians claimed the protests were organized by a few power-hungry men who had large families who would have stolen the funds for their personal benefit. So they would not have protected the vulnerable groups in the camp, including women. The protesters were aggressive, primitive, and patriarchal, the humanitarians claimed. So presumably for the sake of the protection of the vulnerable, for the sake of administrative clarity and efficiency, the Red Cross continued to manage the camp for the next 12 years. Importantly for my talk today, men organized the protests, but women stayed back in the camp to take care of the home and the family. So how can we understand this? Organizing protests to claim better housing, employment, and protection, this is clearly a political act. The fact that camp residents had practically no legal, social, or political rights does not change the fact they were very clearly political subjects. So the men from the camp were outside established and legitimate political structures, but they were loudly questioning and opposing the relations of power which left them outside such structures. So they articulate their idea of a good life and they organize protests around it. This makes them unambiguous, clear political subjects. What about the women from the camp? So they stayed home to take care of the kids. They never organized themselves to go out in the street to protest. Were they pre-political subjects? Can we think about them as political subjects at all if they were, one, outside the established political structures, and two, they seemingly did nothing more than to take care of survival, their own and their families, cooking, cleaning, and child rearing. Now, since Jens asked me to explicitly articulate how I use Butler's concept of the political in my ethnographic research, I will briefly discuss this. So from the perspective of Hannah Arendt, the women from the camp could not be characterized as political subjects. So Judith Butler develops her concept of the political by starting from Hannah Arendt, who says that survival cannot be a goal in itself, since life itself is not an intrinsic good. Only good life makes life worth living. For Arendt, the life of the body is separate from the life of the mind, so the life of the body belongs to the private sphere, the life of the mind belongs to the public sphere. The public sphere for Arendt is where politics takes place. It is the arena of thinking, of acting, and private sphere is where bodily needs are taken care of. It is the sphere of reproduction, survival, sexuality, giving birth, dying, and so on. And in this conception, the very possibility of politics in the public sphere depends on the private sphere and keeping the boundary between the public and the private spheres clear and firm. Butler sets out to offer a different kind of concept of the political. because feminists have noted 50 years ago that personal is political and the private sphere is what makes the politics and the public sphere possible. So in other words, the private sphere is not pre-political or apolitical, it is what makes politics in the public sphere possible. So Butler writes that Arendt clearly understood that the private sphere supported the public sphere of action and thought, but in her view, the political is defined by action, including the active sense of speaking. So the verbal deed became the action of the deliberative and public space of politics. So for Butler, this definition of the political as an active stance, so as an act, a verbal or a physical action, is too restrictive. She writes that if we define politics restrictively as an active stance, verbal and physical, that takes place within a clearly demarcated public sphere, then it seems we are left to call useless suffering and unrecognized labor the pre-political experiences, not actions, that exist outside the political as such. So Butler's concept of the political includes embodied thought and action rather than just verbal and physical action. She writes that we need to develop a new way of thinking about bodily politics, which is done through embodied thought and action. A new body politic that begins with an understanding of human dependency and interdependency, one that can account for the relation between precarity and performativity, between survival and action. So for Butler, in my reading, politics is an element of any social relationship. It is a framework for distribution of an ability to pursue a good life. And this framework is shaped both by institutions and by personal practices. And it is reflected not just in public actions, but also in the intimacy of embodied thinking. And following Butler, I decided to take embodied thoughts of my interlocutors as their political disposition. So for understanding, for instance, I understand their yearning for a particular idea of a good life as an articulation of their political subjectivity. So while men engaged in a clear political action by organizing protests, women from the camp developed their political subjectivity by making an effort to carve themselves into hardworking, respectful and respectable women. So their way to resist the institutional structures which made them disposable was to establish themselves in terms that made their gendered lives valuable by citing more or less conservative gender norms and more or less conservative visions of home. And this is the important thing for me here, and this is actually my main argument for today, that practices of resistance are partial, that we should not romanticize either protests or embodied thinking as the ultimate form of resistance. Both the protests and the embodied thinking in the Kony camp demonstrate resisting one hegemonic structure often means affirming another sort of a hegemonic structure. So what counts as resistance from one perspective can mean compliance and citation of hegemony or hegemony from another perspective. And let me illustrate this argument with three ethnographic vignettes. The first one is about Mirella, a young woman from the camp, who I met as soon as I started doing research and we became friends. One day, Mirella and I ordered tea and apple juice in a Mexican pub in the center of Podgorica, and after a minute, I realized she was visibly nervous. She looked around anxiously and she restlessly moved in her chair, and I tried to figure out why. We had just submitted her application for a work ID at the municipal government. She asked me to help her with this, and I happily obliged. And afterwards, I wanted to hear Mirella's perspective on her encounter with the municipal bureaucrat, so I invited her for a drink in a nearby pub, and she accepted, partly out of kindness, partly because she could not return to the camp on her own, as I soon realized. And after I asked several times what was wrong, Mirella said she was afraid that someone could see her drinking in a pub and then tell everybody in the camp that she had low morals, and this would have ruined her life. As an 18-year-old, unmarried and childless woman, Mirella did not have quite a high social position in the Kony camp. Born in 1998, she had spent practically her whole life in this camp, and gender and age hierarchies within the camp meant that as a young woman, her voice did not mean much when making family decisions. Yet, her reputation was as good as it could get. Mirella was a fine seamstress, a respectful daughter, and she did not shy away from hard housework. She preferred to keep her reputation this way. A drink in a pub in the town could ruin everything if a wrong person saw her there. And once I understood this, we quickly finished our drinks, we called a taxi, and we went back to the Kony camp. So could we say that Mirella led a good life in a bad life? As a refugee who lived in the camp her whole life, would it be useful to see her as a homo saker? During my research, Mirella resolved her legal status, so she gained the citizenship of Kosovo and she registered herself as a foreigner in Montenegro. And until then, the only personal document she had was an IDP registration. As long as she was without citizenship, Mirella was in some sense a homo saker, so a person excluded from the order of the state and law and official politics. Yet in other ways, Mirella was so much more than a bare life. I think that her behavior in the pub illustrates really well that she pursued the particular idea of a moral self. She vigorously pursued this particular moral self that was made possible by the internal social-political universe in the camp. In doing so, she worked towards particular social-political engagements. In the Mexican pub, she felt a clear pressure to leave as quickly as possible. On other occasions, she refused my suggestion to go outside of the camp for a walk, once again because she did not want people to see her as a person of low morals. So she was not forbidden to leave the camp, as she explained. She was, however, expected not to wander around with friends for leisure. It was not forbidden for women to leave the premises of the camp as such, but to do so without clear purpose, to be a young woman with so much free time on her hands, to wander around the camp for relaxation, this was not recommended. So by following certain expectations of her social surrounding of how young women should behave, Mirella carved herself into a particular moral person, hardworking, respectful, and respectable. This was a fairly conservative idea of what a woman, young woman should behave like, yet it gave meaning and purpose to Mirella. In doing so, this conservative gender practice served as a point of resistance against the wider social political setting in which her life was defined as disposable and negligible. So her life was framed as unworthy and disposable, although Mirella resolved her legal status. Despite the new legal regulations, there were many unsettling associations between the camp residents and garbage throughout my fieldwork. First, the word container in Montenegro means a waste container, a garbage bin. Container is where you put garbage, and the same word was used to describe these metal containers where the camp residents lived after 2012, which resulted in racist and very problematic associations. Second, one of the primary means of subsistence for many people in the camp was waste collection, and especially recycling of scrap metal. So as long as they were not legally allowed to enter the labor market, this was the primary means of subsistence for them, and later on for all those who had few or no working skills. For instance, Mirella is unemployed to this day, and sometimes she searches containers. She prefers to make handbags and warm slippers, but she can only sell these items in the town with the help of the Red Cross. Third, the camp residents sometimes used garbage as a metaphor to describe themselves. One man who complained that his application for social welfare program was rejected said that, "I have nothing, I was discarded as garbage." And I think that these three details convey a sense of being disposable, left aside, and discarded, many of my interlocutors expressed in different ways. One situation where I first felt the tension between the pursuit of a moral life and objectively terrible living conditions was when I was invited to the home of one woman. The women who I worked with were often ashamed when people focused just on how terrible the situation in their metal containers was. The situation was objectively terrible, and they were the first to point it out, as I will soon illustrate. Yet they wanted the guests to notice the effort that they invested to make the place nicer, despite everything. So for instance, my interlocutors took off their shoes when entering these metal containers. Despite everything, these metal containers were not garbage holders, they were their home. And my interlocutors never asked guests to do the same, to take off the shoes, but they were visibly glad when people respected their home by doing this. And my interlocutors were much more satisfied when I learned to see their hard work in the home and when I learned how to express admiration for the effort that they invested to turn the place into a home. So carving oneself into this moral person was inspired by a particular image of a home that was shared by many women in the camp. I regularly attended workshops that were family workshops that were organized by the Red Cross for the women in the camp. And during one of the workshops, I asked the women to draw a map of their daily places and activities. So I asked them to draw what they do on a daily basis. And I was surprised to see flowers and pretty houses in many drawings. So the homes that the women drew looked nothing like the metal containers in which they actually lived. And the flowers in these drawings stuck with me. And we can see some of the drawings of this ideal home on the screen. I don't think that I have ever seen a flower in the camp within the metal containers or outside of them. I started noticing flowers in the photographs that Mirella sent me via Viber as well. So asking about the flowers, I learned that the women from the camp developed a particular idea of what the home should look like. So they visualized this home as a nice-looking house with all the amenities, electricity, water, furniture, with flowers, and with enough space to accommodate several generations of the same family. So it is not a coincidence that when she visited Kosovo, Mirella took a picture of herself in front of an unknown house that resembles this vision. And this yearning for a nice big house with flowers is a good illustration of why women from the Koni camp should not be thought of as just bare wives. In the course of 16 years of their displacement, they developed an idea of a good life, and they articulated a political criticism of their predicament on the basis of this idea. The women's yearning for a particular kind of a home presented a criticism of their living conditions. So when they discussed this ideal home, the women also criticized the materiality of the camp where they lived. And let me briefly illustrate how this criticism of the metal containers worked. Once Sandra, who was a Red Cross worker, allowed me to lead the discussion at this family center during a workshop. So as I asked the women who sat in a circle to describe a few problems that they face every day. Mevlud, an outspoken mother of five, started talking about lack of water and sanitation in the metal containers where they lived. So people had to use these shared toilet showers and water taps, and Mevlud said this created many problems for maintaining hygiene and family health. Another woman nodded, and one started describing her own experiences of washing dishes with cold water in the unheated shared toilets during winter while having pneumonia. Sandra, this Red Cross worker, she interrupted them and she took over the discussion and she said, "You don't know Charna, you've been here so shortly. When you hear them talking, you will think that no one gave them anything. And this is not true. There are problems with water, yes. But they also need to know that everybody is responsible for their own hygiene. They regularly get soap and shampoo from us. Why do they not use it?" So in Sandra's view, the dirt and the problems with hygiene were the result of women's hygiene habits, not of extremely poor living conditions in the camp. So Sandra wondered how these women could tolerate dirt. From the humanitarian perspective, the problem was that women from the camp did not know how to, were not aware of the importance of hygiene. And the solution was to teach them about how to use, I don't know, soap and shampoo and so on. So no one had to bother with improving the materiality of the camp. Mevlud and other women knew very well how to use shampoo and soap. And from their perspective, in our talk without Sandra's interruptions, they said the problem was obviously infrastructure and the poor living conditions in the camp, lack of toilets in their living units, and so on. However, whenever they tried to criticize the materiality of the camp in a communal setting, like during this workshop, they were stopped by humanitarian actors. So the problems with water and hygiene were usually individualized. And I think that women articulate their social political subjectivity through these interrupted attempts to criticize materiality of the camp. So yearnings for a big, nice house with flowers gave them a reference point with which to compare their current living conditions and to criticize them and to ask for more, which is ultimately a political claim. So to conclude, my main point for today is that we need to think about resistance as partial, because what means resistance of one hegemonic structure can at the same time affirm another hegemonic structure. And the same can be said both for the active protests of men and the more restrained embodied thinking of the women. And we can see the same conservative gender pattern in the fact that it was only men who went to the city to protest as in the women's interrupted criticism of the metal containers. Another important point that I would like to emphasize is that resistance is not necessarily effective in any form. So it was neither the protests nor the embodied thinking that pushed the Montenegrin government to finally see these people as legal and political subjects. It was the EU pressure and Montenegrin interest to become an EU member that brought about a major change to their lives. Despite their partiality and effectiveness, I find that thinking about different forms of resistance is important. Where there is resistance, there is power, and noticing different forms of resistance can change our understanding of power and politics. And Ethnographica describing resistance can help us to see a homo sacer as a social political being pursuing particular moral projects, as I have tried to illustrate. And paying attention to various forms of resistance can reveal how people pursue intimate visions of a good life in the midst of an objectively bad life. And it is this very pursuit that makes us social and political beings. And I will end here for now, and I look forward to your questions.
Mm-hmm. Do you distinguish that?
No.
Okay.
I know that there are authors in anthropology or morality who make a very clear distinction between the two. I don't. Yeah.
Just want to clarify.
What's the relation in your case between the ethics of becoming like a moral subject and probably imagining yourself as part of a collective or like working towards the place a collective should have, a collectivity should have? You ensure.
It's a really interesting question. Thank you for that. And I would say that it depends on how we understand imagining this collective future and where we think that this imagination takes place. Because I would think that the imagination of these homes, among my interlocutors, who are mostly women, these visions of a good home took place through their informal conversations when they met for a coffee in their home. So they didn't ever sit down in a, I don't know, workshop environment to think about how they, as a collective, as a, I don't know, aroma camp or whatever, want to. They didn't think about themselves as a collective political subject in any sense that would be recognized by any official state or political authorities, let's say. So I would say that becoming an ethical subject is not necessarily an individual thing. I would say this is something that takes place through conversations in a communal setting, but not necessarily in the form of an NGO, if that makes sense.
Still, it could be a very political thing not to have the capacity.
Absolutely.
To imagine yourself as a collective.
Yeah, it could be a very political thing. In what sense?
Like that structures, but like you don't have the navigational capacity to see yourself not only your own future, but the future as a group or people.
I think part of the problem in this particular Konik camp was that these people were ethnically very diverse. They were Roma, Balkan Egyptians, and Ashkalias, and there were huge ethnic tensions that I did not mention in this talk between them. So this was not a group of people who saw themselves as a unit out, like, in opposed to, I don't know, as a unit that could make a singular political claim that would be recognized somewhere else. There were many tensions, ethnically based tensions, and struggles for power among them. I mean, struggles for power, for whatever form of power they were able to access. So in this sense, they were also very, but these struggles were mostly led between men, not between women. So in this sense, you know, they were not a collective political subject in a multicultural way, let's say.
Sharon,
Fagina.
Yeah, thank you very much. Tremendous
presentation.
I wanted to just go back to your definition of good life at the beginning, and I really like how you find it not as a possession, but as a pursuit or direction. And I suppose the first I was thinking, two things there. One was, but does it need some kind of realization? And then as you went through, is the resistance there for the realization and then another form or not? But part of that as well, I suppose I wondered, because I think you've framed it, or your work has been framed, partly in terms of these kind of notions of hope and so on, where you see that in relation to it, whether that you're purposely just kind of not wanting to frame it in that
way. It's a good question, and the one that I would have to, I guess, think a bit more, because I think that I was writing this mostly following my ethnography, and then Jan asked me to elaborate, to think through reflectively on the concept of the political. So this is what I tried to do, but I think that there are obvious links to the body of literature anthropology of hope and home, and that I would need to figure out how to establish a relationship to it. Thanks for that. Yeah, I'm not sure at this moment how to answer this, quite honestly. Yeah.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I like also the way you have
been talking about the complicated connections between good life and a bad life, and in some way it continues our discussions from last week, where the colleague was here talking about minor positionings in major structures and that kind of relation. I see some resemblances here. But I also found it interesting when you pointed to these pictures of the nice houses with the flowers. And when I remember correctly, this was a theme that came up several times. It was not an individual kind of image that was produced. So Alec was asking about a kind of collective that is imagined here, or could it be actually an aspect of what Arjuna Padukai would call imagination as a social practice?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So that is not done individually or in collective terms with all the borders or boundaries between the people residing there, but in a way of a social practice. Could that be?
Yes, absolutely. I would say definitely yes. I think that, but social in the way that my, let's say, interlocutors practiced it, it was really difficult to translate this social into a form that would be politically visible outside of the camp. But this was a social practice, and I think these visions of a good life with flowers and so on, they were definitely shared among them, and very often created in between them through these, I don't know, informal coffee talks and so on. So yes, it was definitely a social practice rather than an act of one person. Yes.
So you could even say a political practice.
Yes, yeah.
If I just may very shortly connect to this, because when I read your definition of the political or politics as a particular redistribution of the ability to live a good life, I had as well to think about Arjun Apadurai's capacity to aspire, and one of the things he's saying is that this capacity to aspire is unequally distributed in a society. So it's in different social groups and classes and so on have a different access to the capacity to aspire. And I was just wondering if that could be an interesting analytical avenue into your material somehow to look how this ability to live a good life is distributed in a certain setting.
Absolutely, and I actually have a quote somewhere in here of Apadurai's work, which I've decided to skip in order to keep the talk a little bit shorter, which speaks directly about that. Yes, I think that people who have been working in India with impoverished groups like him, and he has especially on shelter and so on, and how poor people come together to think about their shelter, to imagine it, and so on. It directly speaks to this story as well. Yeah.
Well, I mean, if we could use then this imagination of flowers and nice houses with flowers as a way to describe the social position of the refugees, for instance.
I think that. Yes and no, I would say. I think that differential evaluation. So, I would say that this whole background story, objective description of the situation in the Koni camp is necessary in order to understand it. I don't think that just from their visions of a good life we can infer the differential evaluation of life. Partly because also their visions of a good life were largely informed by very, let's say, middle class visions of what home should be and so on. So.
This is related to Sharon's and Alex and Irina's question. I just thought of this. I mean, the context is, of course, let's say, broadly speaking, post-socialist. And I didn't hear, maybe you addressed that in other parts of your work, but in the vision of the good life, I didn't hear anything about the nostalgia for socialism. Not in the sense of kind of retro view of what was lost, but what could have been. So it's a kind of future-oriented, hope-filled, what do you call it, vision of a good life. So I was also struck by these houses with flowers as more of a kind of fantasy of what could socialism have been, rather than, you know, aspiration, you know, as in present. embedded in the present. So do you address that anywhere?
No, because I think that the issue of nostalgia for socialism is really, really present among the people who live outside of the camp. I think part of the problem with the Roma in former Yugoslavia is that they have also been largely excluded from the socialist vision of progress and very often lived in very, very impoverished conditions. So their experience of socialism is not the experience of people who have been living in the rest of the town, let's say in Podgorica. So that's why they didn't make these references to socialism, but this is definitely relevant for people who have experienced socialism as some sort of a project which brought them hope and I don't know, belief in
but
progress and so on.
Sometimes you also have the secondary nostalgia, right? Or even for people of younger generation.
Yes, absolutely.
Who haven't lived, so that that phenomenon is also there.
What my interlocutors really express nostalgia for, let's say, oh, it was so good when the Italians and the Americans were here. So when the amount of the humanitarian support was abundant and there was, so.
Thank you so much for your ethnographic material as well. I found that very rich. I have a question about the notion of homo sacer that you're using, because I think it might be overstretching it a little. Because, as far as I understand the concept homo sacer as the one who might be killed with impunity but not sacrificed is not only excluded from the political, or not only excluded from, I don't know, some kind of political institution, and also not just, so to say, a refugee, but someone who is only bare life and nothing but bare life, right? And the examples that Agamben uses, they're actually closer to concentration camps and things like that. So I'm wondering how you're using that concept, and if you could just elaborate a little why you're using it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that question. I think the thing with Agamben mentions, so talks about the camp, and he's, from what I understand, his idea is to analyze the logic of the Western politics as such, so in a very broad and very general terms, and he's not interested in specifics of different camps. So in one place, I think he even mentions that the same logic of inclusion through exclusion is present in all sorts of camps, so in concentration camps, in a stadion in Bari, in an Italian town where Albanian migrants after the Kosovo War were located. So wherever this structure, I can't remember the exact word, but basically wherever there is a sort of a camp, it follows the same logic of exclusion through inclusion through exclusion. And people who live in this state of exception, of inclusion through exclusion, for him, from what I understand, they are not, so the thing with the camp is that there are no, everything depends on, it is a place of, let's say, ambivalence and ambiguity between the law and someone's personal sovereign decision. So it's a place where anything can happen, basically, and the person who lives there, who is forced to, who is just a bare life, has nothing in there. And I think that my problem with this is it's very ahistorical. So it's incredibly politically powerful, and it's incredibly good to think with, but at the same time, ethnographically, when we look at a little bit more deeply what's happening on the ground, different camps are different historical formations. There are camps that follow very different sort of political projects, and these people in the camp have been included through exclusion up to a point, but they haven't been really, the Montenegrin state saw them in some sense. So I would say that homo sacer is a philosophical concept that is not historical or ethnographical necessarily very useful. And this is maybe my starting point, that people, even when they don't have political rights and even when they are living in these terrible, states of legal ambivalence and so on, are still humans. So they still have more than their life, if that makes sense. Yeah.
One question, or actually two questions, about the position of Europe in this whole scenery, because you somehow defined neoliberal governance as very selective, as a selective way of reaching some people, but not all of them. And when you then told that the EU actually asked for the disappearing of these camps, I was wondering, are they actually somehow referring to a older integrative model of polity in doing so? I thought this is just interesting. So is the EU rather, rather somehow an engine for neoliberalization, or perhaps even for a form of polity which is more integrative, which is not somehow, which is not accepting this marginalization process? I thought this is an interesting fact.
It is, and the interest of the EU has really brought a major change in the life of this camp and in the lives of the people who have been living in it. I think that the EU's interest has been led by the mantra of integration, let's say. The problem with this is that the buildings that have been built with EU money are located right next to the camp, completely on the periphery of the town. So it still somehow fails to, I don't know, contribute to the real integration of these people in the life of the town and so on. This is what many NGOs are saying and why they're very unhappy about the location of the new buildings, although the buildings as such are constructed well. I would say that Europeanization and interest of the EU in this camp has created a very different sort of a power system in the camp, whereby the EU supervised the humanitarians, and then humanitarians started supervising the residents of the camp. So what basically happened is that in these family center workshops, the idea was to teach the residents of the camp how to be good citizens one day, once they're allowed to join the Montenegrin polity, let's say, once they're they fulfill the criteria for citizenship, while the whole camp as such was evaluated by the EU in order to evaluate how well Montenegro fulfills criteria for European membership. So there were these, I don't know, nested, let's say, processes of supervision, in which somehow what the residents of the camp wanted and what sort of a life they saw for themselves were completely irrelevant. Does this make sense?
Yeah. Does it change your notion of neoliberal governance then, or?
Why would it?
I mean, as selective?
No, because supervision, I think, in this case was not. It was not discipline. I mean, this is a completely different kind of a discussion. I don't know how deeply I should go into it, but I would say that EU's interest in the camp was also very selective. They were interested in just certain aspects of a life in the camp, which they took as proxies for progress. Thank you. They do, but they expect the women to narrate a certain version of the narrative, which always represents the humanitarians in a good light and does not talk about the problems with the materiality of the camp, let's say. So the whole family center was established, let's say, as a way to teach the women how to use contraception, how to breastfeed, so to how to be, I don't know, a particular kind of a gendered subject. And the problem there, of course, is that whatever women would bring up from their own perspective was ignored if it didn't fit into the narrative that the communitarians have carved out for them, basically, in advance.
Well, yes.
I have another question. thank you very much for your very rich presentation. I was very intrigued by your kind of narration of women seeing very conservative moral values and moral conduct as a mode of resistance, mm-hmm. because it reminded me of the female branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, for example. And so I was wondering whether you had possibilities to speak with women about it, because the interesting thing was that the girl, what was her name? You had a drink in a pub with her, mm-hmm. and she was not referring to other people who might see her and might say, oh, this is a very immoral girl from the conic camp. And mm-hmm. she was referring to the other people of the camp she wouldn't mm-hmm. want to be seen with you mm-hmm. and drinking in a pub. So it seems to me very much like morality, and a very conservative morality seems to me very much a mode of establishing also very strong, and maybe a resistance, a group identity.
Mm-hmm.
So I was wondering what that was a coin. I was very much intrigued mm-hmm. actually by your narration mm-hmm. of this morality code, because it seemed to be a really important thing for people.
I would say yes, I would say definitely, and I would say that citing this conservative idea of womanhood and manhood, let's say, contributed to sense of self as a social being, let's say, and their sense as I don't know, people who live in the camp. So somehow there was very clear, for very obvious reasons, sense of separation from the town, and doing gender, let's say, in a conservative way, contributed to this and was part of this. So yes. Yeah.
Okay, perhaps a final question. Regina already mentioned last week's lecture, and I see as well some relating points. For instance, this interest in life. Michele spoke about life at the margins. It's not your notion, but so his fields are drug addicted people in Bucharest, or homeless people in Bucharest, mm-hmm. and he basically proposed as well a certain notion of at the margins as the product of certain struggles in hegemonic relations, mm-hmm. and so I see this one relating point, this interest and being interested in life. And the politics of life that might happen in everyday situations. Mm-hmm. And then Michele, he proposed, I think he called it political openings, so something which takes place in everyday ethnographic encounters. His example was a woman in a charity organization, I think a kind of food bank in Italy, a charity organization. She was given a piece of butter which was expired already, and she asked him, the person giving the butter, I think it was Michele, don't you have another piece of butter? Mm-hmm. And Michele called this a political opening, in a way that he said this whole rationality of European humanitarian governance of the poor became tangible in this mm-hmm. situation, and we basically should try to find that kind of political openings in our ethnographic encounters. Mm-hmm. So to trace this to rationalities, power structures, the workings of power, governance, and so on. And I just had the feeling that resonates very, very much mm-hmm. with your interest in how life is debated, or how life is enacted in mm-hmm. these very specific everyday situations. And I was wondering if you could somehow connect to this idea to trace them from these to look for political openings. I hope it was clear what
Michele, as far as I understand. I would very simply call this an act of resistance, let's say. So what he would call an act of opening, a political opening, I would interpret it as resistance. At the same time, I would really like caution against taking these acts of political opening or resistance as somehow, I don't know, revolutionary. Because I do not think they have necessarily, they express political subjectivity and they're relevant, but they do not necessarily have the ability to change the power relations. And at the same time, I should mention, I mean, I was talking about Ruth Butler, I've never mentioned once subversion, which is one of her key concepts. And this is because I think there is nothing particularly subversive in my ethnographic fieldwork. I think subversion is very different from resistance. And subversion refers to a citation of the hegemonic framework to such an extent, like following it in such a way it actually twists it and makes us, helps us to think about things in a different way. And none of this took place in, and this would have been something that I would see as potentially revolutionary. None of this has happened during my fieldwork in my experience. So this is why I'm talking about resistance and why I caution against taking resistance as a potentially politically productive revolutionary act, if that makes sense.
That makes sense, but just a short short addition. I think he meant it as well, or most of all, as an analytical opening on structures of power. So he didn't mean forcefully that this confrontation,
this confrontation
means somehow the humanitarian dominance is questioned there and really.
It was these flowers, which
exactly,
is such a, I know, irrelevant thing that actually got me thinking about all of this. Like, I was really surprised to see all of these flowers, and I was like, have I not, what am I missing here, right? What have I not seen in this camp? And this, I would say, yes, analytically very relevant, yes.
I also want to draw on that example, and thank you for bringing it up again. I was thinking that actually this political moment that Michele was describing was very much related to the ethnographic encounter, and also about how we can kind of enlarge our political perspective here. And was actually the whole story was that Michele, as the one who gave the butter, the expired butter, to that person, and was asked about that, he was also challenged in a way. And actually the story ended, he told us that he, in this moment, he couldn't relate to it in any way. And she said, don't you have any other butter? And he said, no, don't you want this one? And then the moment was over. And I found that very interesting, whether we are able in that very moment to pick up that situation and create a critical, analytical moment with the people we encounter. Not afterwards or before or something, in this very moment. That's the way I understood him. And I think it's not really totally different from what
it sounds
very similar. It's more on that ethnographic process that we're doing right now, so we are communicating.
Yeah, I would totally agree with this. I do not think that anyone, if it's analytically productive, it gets us thinking differently about our fieldwork. I don't think anyone will be able in the moment to respond in a way that they later on think that they should have. Because I think that if it forces us to rethink our ethnographic fieldwork, then we can't in the moment necessarily respond properly. Yeah.
We can try,
yeah.
And it's a different communication than the one he was
recording. Okay, before we give a final applause, I would like to ask Omila to give us a short idea about what will happen next week. Omila was so kind to organize next week Institutes Colloquium. So what will happen there? I mean, we could do this in German, I think, as it is in German next week, and Chana understands German, so however you want.
Danke. Ja, ich wechsle ins Deutsche, weil es nächste Woche im Deutschen erfolgen wird, der Vortrag, oder die Filme und Vortrag. Es ist eine Veranstaltung, die vom Labor Migration mitgeplant ist, die auch anknüpft an das Archiving Refuge, weil es geht wieder um Archive. Und zwar ist es ein Projekt, das vorgestellt wird, das in einem größeren Gesamtprojekt entsteht. Das heißt Archive außer sich und das Archive als ein Ort der Produktion ansieht. Und zwar kommen die beiden Filmemacherinnen und Merle Kröger und Mareike Bernin. Merle Kröger ist auch bekannt, vielleicht noch bekannter als Krimi-Autorin. Und sie sprechen hier und zeigen Filme von und über Navina Sundaram, wo ich befürchte, dass die meisten hier im Raum die nicht kennen, die aber eine sehr wichtige Figur in den 70er, 80er Jahren im westdeutschen Fernsehen war. Das erste braune Gesicht als Moderatorin und Journalistin im Weltspiegel. Und in dem Projekt von Merle und Mareike geht es darum, ein Online-Archiv herzustellen mit den Arbeiten von Navina Sundaram. Es geht darum zu fragen, es geht einmal um die Ebene von ihrer Arbeit, aber es geht auch darum zu fragen, warum ist Navina Sundaram so unbekannt und wie kann man Archive, also es liegt alles im Fernseharchiv, aber da guckt keiner rein. Also es geht so um verschiedene Ebenen von Archiv in dieser Diskussion. Wird so eben auch mit Bildern untermalt und Sharon McDonald hat sich bereit erklärt, einen kurzen Kommentar zu sprechen am Ende. Also es wird sicher spannend mit den beiden Filmen.
Okay, so thank you very much for presenting this and for organizing this. But most of all, I hope to welcome you all again to this promising next week's lecture. And most of all, thanks very much to Chana for coming and sharing your thoughts with us. Thanks.